Okay. Thanks, Amy Lynn.
All right. We don't know if this is going to work, this recording thing, but if it does, we'll have it captured. And we also don't know if it's going to be any good, both in terms of content and in terms of technology. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for coming. I've been asked to... I guess I have to stay close to the mic. Maria asked me to actually think about covering a number of things today. And one of them is the latest brouhaha on 10b5-1 plans. And she also asked me to be ready to talk about things like the SEC whistleblower program and news and whatever is happening inside the SEC. This formal presentation is going to be focused on 10b5-1 trading plans and the stuff surrounding it, because I think, frankly, it's the more interesting of the three topics. But I'm happy to answer questions afterwards on any subject that anyone wants to ask me questions about. Okay, so my topic is corporate executives and insider trading. Our rule 10b5-1 trading plans really being abused. For those of you who don't know me, the only reason that I have any knowledge at all about this topic is that for 5 years I headed the Executive Financial Services Department at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, which used to be Citi Smith Barney. I don't know what it is now. What is it now?
Morgan
Stanley. Okay. And that department administered and continues to administer 10b5-1 trading plans for all of Morgan Stanley's clients. Now ably administered by my friends Mark Bach and Richard Fisher, who are here in the audience. And in the context of that position, I got to learn a lot about 10b5-1 trading plans and got to think a lot about 10b5-1 trading plans. And so it's with that experience and also my current and prior experience as a securities litigator that I approach this subject. Let me see if I can get this to work right. There we go. Okay. So here's what I want to cover today. You have to forgive me. It's a great room, but it's not particularly good on speakers, I notice. What I want to cover today is, first of all, what's going on in terms of the news? What's the news? What's the buzz on 10b5-1 trading plans? And then I want to talk a little bit about, what 10b5-1 trading plans are. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I'm assuming most everyone here knows the basics of 10b5-1 trading plans, so I'm not going to go into a deep, deep dive on them. But I do want to make sure that everyone's on the same page. And then we're going to go into some problems that I foresee, which I think are the real crux of the issue in terms of the issues that are being discussed in the press. And I'm going to suggest at the end of the day that the real problem aren't 10b5-1 trading plans at all. The real problem are the predicate for 10b5-1 plans, which is the existence of corporate windows and the management of corporate windows. And that the better way of looking at 10b5-1 trading plans is not as a problem that is somehow causing insider trading, but as a possible solution to the problems that are being reported in the press. Okay, so feel free to ask questions, by the way, at any time. We will certainly try to answer them, and these things tend to go better if they're a little more interactive rather than me simply being up here as a talking head. Okay, so what's the news about 10b5-1 trading plans? Well, the news is that the Wall Street Journal is on a tear talking about 10b5-1 trading plans. There have been 9 articles written in the journal from November until just a week or so ago, I guess. And it started with an article on November 27th in which they reported on an internal study that they did, which showed that executives trading in 10b5-1 trading plans had a 10% profit advantage over executives not trading in 10b5-1 trading plans. And that was the start of it. And of course, being a newspaper, being a Rupert Murdoch newspaper, it sprinkles this sort of very prosaic study with a lot of anecdotal evidence of people making huge profits in 10b5-1 trading plans. And of course, that is what makes news. Now, Of course, whenever you have anything like this, you're going to have follow-up. There's going to be cries for action by various groups, investor groups, fund groups, all of whom, by the way, are pursuing their own agendas and are not necessarily have the same agenda that the SEC would have. But nevertheless, there's cries for action. There's SEC, of course, has to do something, so they will investigate the more dramatic instances of people actually making huge profits, because there might really be insider trading going on there. And so consequently, you know, that's where it currently stands. Now, is this news? And, you know, when I started seeing these reports, my reaction was, you know, we've seen it before. This is exactly the same thing that happened back in 2007 when Alan Jagielinzer put out his initial study that showed that insiders trading in 10b5-1 plans had a 7% profit advantage over insiders not trading in 10b5-1 profit 10b5-1 plans. That study, you may recall, prompted then Business Week to go on a tear with half a dozen articles talking about how executives were gaming 10b5-1 trading plans. That led to various calls for action until finally one of the SEC commissioners said, we are looking at 10b5-1 trading plans. I think her word was hard. And so what came of it? Nothing. You know, the SEC's hard look at 10b5-1 trading plans resulted in absolutely no changes to the plan. And the same thing is happening today. Last week, I guess the Wall Street Journal, the last or the latest in any event of its articles on the brouhaha over 10b5-1 trading plans, has this quote: "The SEC hasn't ruled out taking action to amend its guidance or regulation on the plans, but no such review is underway." It says war, actually way. That's what happens when you do slides at midnight. Underway, according to a person familiar with the agency. Well, okay. So one can ask, well, why not? Why is the supposed edge that insiders have when using 10b5-1 plans falling on deaf regulatory ears, both in 2007 and today? And what happened in 2007 is, you know, there was this brouhaha, and then it died away, and for 5 years we didn't hear a thing until the Wall Street Journal raised the issue again, and I suspect that's what's going to happen again this time. But it does raise an interesting question as to why it is that... you know, why it is that it's so hard to get, you know, a grip on this issue. Now, one thing that we should point out at the get-go, I don't have a slide on it, but I do want to point it out. It's not at all clear, by the way, that this, first of all, it's not clear that this 7 or 10% edge really exists. There are countervailing studies that suggest that it's not really there, that it's sort of a statistical fluke. On the other hand, if you assume that there is an edge, there are lots of reasons why that edge is not indicative of insider trading or any trading on insider knowledge. For one thing, the most obvious thing is this. 10b5-1 trading plans, by and large, are populated with limit orders at various prices. Okay. Now, if you are trading normally in an open window or just at market prices, you're going to be tracking, your profits are going to be tracking up and down whatever the prevailing market price is. If your trading regime is populated with limit orders, you are cherry picking the top of the market. And if you keep cherry picking the top of the market, you are obviously going to do better. So an obvious explanation for the advantage that people have in trading in 10b5-1 trading plans is that the plans themselves are imposing a certain investment discipline on them that their confreres don't have. And that's the simplest explanation. There are others that have that go deeper into the statistics, but that's the simplest explanation. But I'm going to put that to the side for my talk today. I'm going to assume that, in fact, there is an edge, some kind of an edge. Jagielinzer said 7%, Wall Street Journal said 10%, whatever it is, I'm going to assume that there is some kind of an edge that insiders have when they're trading in these plans. And I want to explore where that edge is coming from. You know, what's the source of that edge? Okay, so to go down that road, I want to start off, first of all, very briefly, let's talk about Rule 10b5-1 trading plans. By the way, just a show of hands, how many in here do not know what a 10b5-1 trading plan is? Are there any real neophytes? No? Okay, good. Then I'm safe. So you can't really understand 10b5-1 plans unless you understand insider trading, and you can't understand insider trading unless you are very familiar with the concept of material non-public information, sometimes abbreviated MNPI. And here's the basics, and it's important, right? First of all, the information has to be factual information. And by factual information, it's the kind of stuff that you can prove in court. That's the way to think about it. And so consequently, ideas, hunches, speculation, there are cases galore that basically say that is not the kind of information that can give rise to insider trading. It's got to be factual, you know. And being a litigator, you know, my sense of this is that factual information really means, you know, the practical concern is, can you prove it? If you have to go to court, can you prove it? Can you bring up evidence to show that this information really exists? And if you can't, or if it's too hard to do it, then it's not the kind of factual information that gives rise to an insider trading charge. The information has to be material. Simple definition, it's got to be important to a reasonable investor. You know, not a particularly sensitive investor, a reasonable investor. Important to the investment decision of a reasonable investor. Now, the issue, and it's got to come from inside the corporation. That's a given for our discussion. Now, the thing that to keep in mind is that both the factuality and the materiality of information are hard decisions to make before the fact. In other words, if an executive is looking at a particular piece of data and trying to decide, well, is this factual, is this material, the odds are that if that data is sort of on the edge, that the executive is going to be biased in favor of the determination of that data that allows him to do what he wants to do. That's just human nature, okay? And that is why corporations will put that decision of factuality and materiality in the hands of supposedly a neutral party, which generally is going to be, you know, general counsel. Okay, so now, what's it mean to trade on the basis of material non-public information? And this gives rise to the famous use versus possession debate that bedeviled the SEC in the late 1990s. The statute says you have to use or employ, you know, a deceptive device in trading in order to be charged with insider trading. Use or employ means you actually have to use it. It's hard to prove the use of information. It's not impossible to prove, but harder to prove. It's easier to prove the mere possession of information. And so for years and years, the SEC basically strategized insider trading cases by simply saying, if you are in possession of material non-public information at the time you trade, then we're going to presume that you've used that information. And what happened in the late 90s, and some of you who've heard me talk on this before know this already, is that some smart defense lawyers basically went to court and say, well, wait a minute, we may have had that information, but we didn't use it in the trade. You know, we based the trade on something else. We based the trade on the fact that we needed to pay a tuition bill next week, or that we had a taxes due, or that we were buying a house and had to make a down payment. That's why we traded. We didn't trade because we knew that our company was about to be awarded this humongous contract. That's just, you know, beside the point. Now, and courts essentially said, yeah, if you can prove that, yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to use the information. Merely having it is not, you know, that's not the key to, that's not the test. Now, obviously, this caused the SEC all sorts of problems because it would make it much more difficult for them to prove insider trading cases, and Rule 10b5-1 comes out of that debate. Rule 10b5-1 essentially says that if you possess the information, then you're going to be presumed to have used that information if you trade during a time when you have that information. So, and this solves a very practical problem for the SEC. Now, you know, It is in saying that, in making that kind of rule that the SEC sort of backed itself into a corner, because you can't make that kind of rule without carving out an exception to it. Because the rule, possession presumes use, is not consistent with the statute. It's not consistent with what the 34 Act actually says about inside information. It's an evidentiary hook that the SEC uses to make it easier for them to prove cases. But once they put that hook into a rule, the exception to that hook had to follow. Otherwise, the rule wouldn't make any sense. And the exception is, if in fact you can show that although you possessed this information when you traded, you didn't use it, okay, and if you can show it in the following way, then you can have an affirmative defense to an insider trading charge. And it is the carve-out that creates the Rule 10b5-1 plan, as we know it. And the carve-out is, you know, I mean, we all know what the carve-out is. You have to have a written document created when you did not have inside information. You have to be able to show that you didn't have inside information when you created the document. And the document is a, you know, binding contract or an instruction or a plan of trading to a third party without subsequent influence from you. This has morphed over time into what we commonly know as the 10b5-1 trading plan, which is inevitably a contract between an executive and a brokerage firm that provides a series of orders for the brokerage firm to execute without any interference from the executive at some point future in time. Okay? Everybody knows that, right? Okay. So that's where the trading plan comes from. But the key to the 10b5-1 trading plan affirmative defense is that you do not have material non-public information at the time you create the plan, at the time you make the decision to trade. That's the key. So a good plan does nothing more than shift the focus of attention from the time when you trade to the time when you create the plan. Everybody get that? Okay. Now, so far so good. I mean, we haven't said anything, you know, too odd. Now, the corporation's dilemma. So let's move to the corporation side. Okay. And, you know, how do you prevent insider trading while still allowing insiders to trade? That's kind of the gist of it. So, first of all, to start out with, you know, what's the corporation's responsibility for insider trading? They really don't have a legal obligation. They have no legal liability if one of their insiders trades. The issue is the fear the corporations have that somehow they will be held open to criticism if they don't put something in place that at least polices and, you know, that restricts somehow the ability of their executives to trade. It has to do with what's so-called gatekeeper liability. The point of fact is the corporation is in the best position to prevent insider trading by their executives. And the fact that they are in the best position to prevent insider trading makes it logical to think that they might be held liable if their insiders do trade. There's no case that actually has held any corporation liable for, you know, the insider trading of their executives in which the corporation wasn't, you know, sort of actively in cahoots. But nevertheless, the fear of that, and also the fear of the risk of SEC investigations, of bad press, of being in the front page of the journal, those are the things that keep corporations diligent in terms of preventing insider trading by their executives. So all corporations have an interest in making sure that their executives do not engage in insider trading, and therefore all corporations have in place various insider trading policies. Now, I'll raise this question because I think it gets to the heart of where we're going here. Don't executives always have inside information? Now, you know, I ask that question of lawyers, and you know, they start thinking about it because they know that in fact executives do trade, and they don't trade on inside information, at least in theory. But real people, you know, the attitude of real people is, well, of course executives have better information about their companies than everybody else. I mean, they ought to have better information about their companies than everybody else. So how is it that they're capable of trading? Well, I mean, in order to be able to trade, there has to be a point in time when, in fact, all material non-public information is already disclosed. And if that is the case, then by definition, there is no material non-public information that could be the predicate of an insider trading charge. Now, when is everything disclosed? Well, everything is supposed to be disclosed in the earnings report and in the quarterly filings and the annual filings. That's what the rules say. The rules say when you do a quarter, when you do your earnings report or in your quarterlies and your annuals, you're supposed to disclose all material information, all information material to the investment decision of a reasonable investor. That's the same definition for insider trading. And so consequently, the theory is once you've made those disclosures, by definition, there is no material non-public information available that is not disclosed. It's all disclosed. And that creates the point in time at which executives and the investing public are on supposedly a level playing field. That's the theory. Okay? And so this gives rise to corporate insider trading policies. Now, there are really only three ways that corporations can police insider trading. The strict kind is to simply prohibit it. Simply say executives can never buy and sell stock in their own company. Okay? Now, nobody that I know has that policy in place. Well, maybe some do. Some companies, I guess, do. But, you know, by and large, you know, that's too restrictive. Okay? The next level up is individual preclearance by general counsel. If you want to trade, you have to go to general counsel and get permission on a trade-by-trade basis. Okay? Some companies have that. But in a large corporation, that becomes very unwieldy, except for the very, very top handful of people. Okay? The more common is the so-called open window period. And this is a blanket permission to almost everybody, with some exceptions, obviously. There may be exceptions for the CEO and again, a handful of others at the very, very top. But by and large, an open window during which general counsel has made the determination that all material information about the company has been disclosed, it is out in the open, and there isn't any knowledge inside that the outsiders don't have. Okay? And that's the window. Okay? Everybody follow me so far? Now, this is what a window period looks like, all right? Essentially, you have a period beginning about 6 weeks before an earnings release and extending typically about a day or two after the earnings release when people can't trade. That is the closed window. And that's generally followed by, mathematically it has to be, another 6 weeks or so after that when people can trade. Because 6 weeks later, you end up with, again, at that six-week period where you're 6 weeks before the earnings release. Now, where's this 6 weeks before the earnings release comes from? That's typically when it is felt that financial reports are starting to roll up from divisions for incorporation into a comprehensive financial report for the company. And so consequently, once those reports start rolling up, the feeling is that it is more likely then that information that is material will come into the hands of executives. Okay? So what you've got is this assumption that before that roll-up occurs, nobody knows anything. That's the assumption behind windows. And if that is true, then any trading decision made during the open window has to be fair game because you don't know anything. You have no material non-public information during the open window. So any trading decision that you make is fine. It's not, you know, it can't give rise to an insider trading charge. And it should not make any difference. I've yet to hear any argument saying it makes any difference if that trading decision is executed immediately or is executed later in time. All right? Because it's the trading decision that needs to be infected with inside information in order for an insider trading charge to be lodged. And so consequently, if you can trade in an open window, you can put in a trading instruction in an open window. You can adopt a 10b5-1 plan in an open window. It makes no difference, right? So 10b5-1 trades are 10b5-1 trades that are based on a plan created in an open window should be completely safe from infection by insider trading, because that's the predicate that they're made in, that the window is sanitized. Okay? And if they are not free from material inside information, then what it tells you, what it has to tell you, is that the window itself is not free of material inside information. Can't be anything else. Okay? Now, so this gets us now to, I think, the guts of the problem and the more serious problem. The press is focusing on 10b5-1 trading plans, but the real focus ought to be on windows themselves, on the theory of corporate windows, because that's where the real problem is. Okay? There are at least two problems with windows. Okay? And I've put them here on the slide, slide 19. Okay? First of all, how can we know that the windows have been closed soon enough? That's problem number one. And problem number two is, what about information that is not sufficiently factual to give rise to insider trading charges, but is still meaningful enough to give an edge to executives? Okay. These two problems are inherent in the law. I mean, it's not anything that there's no easy solution to these two problems. One has to do with the knowledge of the corporation made in good faith as to when it is that information is sufficiently, has gelled sufficiently to close the window. And the other one has to do with, frankly, information that just doesn't rise to the level of stuff that is actionable in an insider trading case. So let's look and see, all right? So we know how to open a window. We mentioned it before. You do your filings. If you've done your filings correctly, you've disclosed all material information. Therefore, by definition, there is no non-disclosed material information. You can open the window. Everyone is on a level playing field. That's when the window opens. But now, how do you close a window? How do you know when to close a window? Well, the fact is, a corporation doesn't know when to close a window. It doesn't really know. It's always general counsel's best guess. Okay. The aim is always to close the window before executives get such information from the field that they get a sense of where the quarterly earnings are going. And there's an assumption built into this. The assumptions are that material non-public information is financial in nature and that it doesn't, hit the consciousness of executives until kind of they see it in reports. Now, and it doesn't gel. I use the word gel. It doesn't gel into something actionable until sometime after these reports start rolling up. Now, the problem... there, it went away. Okay. So the problem, of course, is that these assumptions are kind of all soft, and they get softer and softer every year as communication becomes... faster and faster and more intimate. It's really too much to think that corporate executives don't know where their corporation is heading until they start seeing financial reports. It's not, it's not quite believable, all right? So you have to consider that information is floating around a corporation, buzz is occurring within the corporation during the open window period, long before reports start rolling up from divisions. They have a sense. But remember the definition of factual information. A sense is not a fact, but a sense is enough to give an edge. Okay, so there's part of the problem. This is open window period. In other words, non-public information can gel any point along the way. It doesn't happen exactly when the window closes. And consider that most 10b5-1 plans, at least when I was around, actually were adopted very late in the window period. You know, I mean, often on the very last day. Now, yeah, there are all, you know, there's always been reasons, right? I mean, council, you know, was lazy, didn't put it together in time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that most plans do get adopted late in the window periods. And so consequently, there is this suggestion that, in fact, the executives putting those plans in place are not entirely, you know, deaf, dumb, and blind in terms of what is about to happen in their companies, even, you know, before the window closes. That's problem number one with Windows. Problem number two with Windows has to do with the nature of information. And so I thought I'd try to present it to you this way. I don't know if you recognize this. This is Pablo Picasso's Head of a Bull. It is in the Picasso Museum in Paris. You can go there and look at it if you like. I picked this particular example because I thought it would be a good way of illustrating the next point. What Picasso said, and I have the quote, but I can remember it, I think, well enough. What he said when in putting this together, he said, guess how I did that? I was walking by a rubbish heap, and I found a bicycle seat and a handlebar just lying there. And the thought came to me that if I put them together in a certain way, it would look like that. So I just picked them up, took them to my workshop, and then later on I soldered them together, and that was it. Now, okay, there you go. So what do you got? This is the components, right? Bicycle seat and handlebars. Notice the plus sign in the center. That's what Picasso adds to it. Okay, that's his insight. All right. Now let's take this and put it on our chart. Okay. Look what you've got. You've got, if you're a corporation, some inventory, bicycle seats and handlebars, fully disclosed in your 10K, 10Q. Okay. You're in the open window. In the open window, Picasso spots these two things, and has his insight. Right there in the open window. But he doesn't solder them together until afterwards in the closed window. Now, that plus sign is the insight that gives Picasso the edge. If this were a corporation, he could go trade because he knows, based on the inventory that he's got that's fully disclosed, the facts, he knows what he's going to do with it. And the information that he has that he's carrying around in his head is not factual. It's an idea. He doesn't know that it's going to work. I mean, he could solder them together and it could look like, you know, something worthless. But that's his insight. Now, I picked this example, and it's sort of an exaggerated example, but I'm telling you, this happens all the time in little ways, in little ways and big ways. I mean, how long was Steve Jobs walking around with a piece of paper in his pocket that looked like an iPod before he actually produced it? In fact, if you look at it from this perspective, you know, the shocking thing is not that executives have a 7 to 10% edge. It's that they only have a 7 to 10% edge. And the shocking part of it is that if they only have a 7 to 10% edge, you know, it's because of the extreme level of mediocrity that runs America's corporations today. See, when I was at Morgan Stanley, I couldn't say things like that. But now I'm totally unplugged. But this is the upshot, is that windows alone, they don't work. You can never be confident that you've closed them soon enough. And you can never police the sort of, you know, intangible insights that executives have during open windows because they don't rise to the level of material non-public information. Both of those factors can give insiders a trading edge. You know, now the SEC, mind you, has never formally accepted or adopted the concept of windows. It's an invention of securities lawyers based on the notion of what is material information for purposes of a securities filing, right? But if you look at it in this perspective, you can see that there's a lot of stuff that happens in the open window and a lot of knowledge and information in an open window that can give executives, should give executives, far more of an edge than what's being showed in these studies. So, and now we go back to my friend Alan Jagelinzer. who I discovered doing some research last week, in late 2011, early 2012, put out a paper, which has not gotten a lot of press, but to my mind is more important than any of the stuff that you did on 10b5-1 trading plans. What this paper did is it compared the trading profits of executives who traded in open windows as opposed to executives who were required to get general counsel preclearance for their trades. And what he found was that executives who traded in open windows had a 7% edge over executives who had to be pre-cleared. Okay. Now, mind you, this is the same 7% that he found back in 2007 when he looked at people in 10b5-1 trading plans versus people not in 10b5-1 trading plans. So what you're seeing here is sort of a confluence of logic and evidence that tells you the problem, you know, notwithstanding the Wall Street Journal and everyone else, the problem is not 10b5-1 trading plans. The problem is windows. Windows and 10b5-1 trading plans go hand in glove. 10b5-1 trading plans, most of them, are adopted in companies that have a windows regime. Okay. And so that, I'm suggesting, is where this where we ought to be looking. Now, where does this go? Well, I think to some extent where this goes is that if you really want to be serious about not only policing technical insider trading, where the information is factual and material, you know, in ways that we've discussed, but if you want to prevent sort of the appearance of impropriety, the appearance of insider trading, if you want to take away the edge that executives of corporations naturally are going to have, you shouldn't be looking at 10b5-1 plans as the problem. You should be looking at windows as the problem, and you should be looking at 10b5-1 plans as a solution to the problem. And if you're going to be serious, this is what you would do. Okay? You would write a 10b5-1 trading regime for your corporation that, I mean, I say first, but actually it should be, what should be first is what I've marked as third, is to require all executives to have 10b5-1 trading plans and to prohibit trading in open windows without a plan. That's what you should do. And you should use open windows only as a time period to adopt plans. And then what you should do is put a cooling off period into the plan. 30 to 90 days is becoming more and more accepted. The longer, the better. This is all best practices that I'm sure you've heard before. But now maybe you have a better appreciation of where they're coming from. The cooling off period simply acknowledges what I think we've been looking at, which is that even during an open window period, there's enough information out there to give executives an edge. You acknowledge it up front. The cooling off period basically says we're going to let 30, 60, 90 days pass so that whatever information you've got of whatever nature is allowed to either be disclosed or dissipate or, you know, kind of reduce its impact on your trading profits. That's the purpose of the cooling off period. And the second thing, the next thing you would do with these plans is you would eliminate the free termination provision. We didn't talk about the free termination provision, but the fact of the matter is most plans these days, you can terminate them anytime you want to. You can only amend them during an open window period, but you can terminate them at any time. And the theory of that is that if you're terminating a plan and you're eliminating the possibility of trading, then you're eliminating the one predicate that you need in order to be charged with insider trading, which is to trade. But if you eliminate that free termination provision, because that really gives you an edge. I mean, it allows you to terminate a plan if things are going better than you expect and keep a plan in place if things are going as bad as you expect. And it gives you an option, really, you know. So you want to eliminate that. Eliminate the free terminations, put in a long cooling off period, adopt company-centric plans, put in a policy that requires executives to be in trading plans if they're gonna trade. And my bet is that you will find this edge that is being reported in the journal and the various studies slowly to evaporate over time because you've essentially eliminated the ability of people to basically use open windows as a time when they can trade. That's my story. Any questions? Yes, Maria. No. No. And I'm not surprised, because the kind of information we're talking about is going to be difficult to pin down as factual and material based on the cases that exist that define what it means to be factual and material. See, the point I'm making is that the cases are themselves limited in what they protect against. Insider trading law itself is limited in what it protects against. You know, there's a lot that it doesn't protect against. Yeah, Rich.
Do you think the SEC will review the rule and therefore make changes?
Who the hell knows what the SEC will do? My hunch is no. For a number of reasons. Number one, I think they looked at it in 2007 and decided there wasn't anything they could do. And I don't think they're going to look at it again. And the second reason is, frankly, they've got too much on their plate. And this is not, I don't think this is way up on their radar. I mean, look, let's face it. A 7% edge means that if I'm an insider and you're not and you've made a $10 profit on a stock, I've made a $10.70 profit on a stock. Big whoop is to a large extent the attitude. Yeah, Mark.
That plus sign illustration is a great illustration. I think it's very interesting.
I haven't copyrighted it, so you can steal it if you want.
No, I don't want to steal it, but you should play with it. But I guess my question is, there are a lot of people that work sort of in that plus sign group. I mean, it's not just corporate executives.
Correct.
There are buy side analysts. There are sell side analysts.
Correct.
There are a lot of people that are looking at the plus sign that, wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night thinking about nothing else but that plus sign.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to make the assumption that, the executives can value the plus sign better than those who are coming in from the outside asking the questions and, an individual like me wouldn't be in there getting that kind of information. But certainly...
Mm-hmm.
The large brokerage firms, all the research firms would be in there, and that's what they do all day, every day.
Yep.
Probably even more so than someone who's sort of dealing with, the supply line issue I have right now in Asia, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you...
I don't know. I mean, these are all relative.
How do you try to balance that out? Because I haven't really seen a lot of press about... how that plus sign...
Well, I have to tell you, though,
by others outside the firm.
Yeah, well, something? I mean, one clue to that is you look at the Wall Street Journal articles, and you'll see a lot of pressure and a lot of the pressure and the brouhaha is coming from fund managers who one would think are, populated with people who are looking at the plus signs.
Yep.
And they feel they're being disadvantaged. Okay, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of current research in behavioral economics that basically casts a lot of doubt on the ability of outsiders looking at plus signs, from inside, from the outside looking in, on their ability to really be able to judge what's going on. And conversely, there's a lot of research that shows that people who are in the mix, who are really experts and who are seeing the same problems over and over again, from the trenches, have a heightened level of intuition that outsiders can't match. So the answer is, I think that your predicate is right. I think that people on the inside do have a better sense of the plus sign than people on the outside, no matter what the people on the outside are doing. The so-called objectivity of the outside analyst is probably more of a hindrance than a help. Okay. Now, mind you, the people on the inside, this is a relative thing, right? So there's a 7% balance. That means that there are also a lot of people that are getting it wrong on the inside. Because if a lot of people were getting it right, it'd be a lot more than 7%, as I said, which is why, I said, it's only 7%, really? I thought you were going in another direction, which is to say, what about policing, you know, the insights of outsiders in terms of stock trading? The answer to that is something I didn't mention, which is that inside information kind of by definition has to come from inside the company. So if you're an outsider deriving your own, it's fair game. In other words, in fact, interestingly enough, that's why Congress passed the Stock Act. I don't know if you know this, the Stock Act, the Stock Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act last year. I mean, congressmen and their aides were basically trading on stocks because they knew what laws Congress was going to pass that was going to affect those stocks. Now, people said, that's not illegal? And the answer is no, it's not illegal. That information did not come from inside the company. Insider trading laws don't reach it. So you needed a new law to basically capture that kind of trading. It's a weird world, what can I tell you? Any other questions? Yeah.
How far down the corporate chain are these plans typically adopted?
Well, I tell you, the plan, the key is not the insider status, for Section 16 status, for example. It's not 144 status. The key really is access to information, access to non-public information. So it is whoever, it could go pretty far down the chain. I mean, there are companies, for example, with fairly wide open internal communication policies, a culture of information sharing, high-tech companies, smaller high-tech and pharmaceutical companies, everyone is subject to Windows. You know, everyone has knowledge, has access to non-public information, and so consequently, everyone, you know, should have plans available to them and should be in plans. I think probably if you're in a mature, I don't know if there are any anymore, but, you know, a mature, old-line, brick-and-mortar manufacturing firm where you're basically manufacturing widgets and you just, you know, you know what the process is. There's nothing special about it. You just crank them out and sell them. That's a different culture. There, really, you know, the only knowledge that is going to be material is, you know, how have your revenues changed from quarter to quarter? That's more of a financial situation. That's more the prototype for the creation of a Windows policy. You know, I mean, the other thing I probably should have mentioned here is that as those companies morph into service entities and high technology entities, as those old brick and mortar companies start vanishing, if you will, then the old assumptions behind the open window theory break down even further. Any other questions? Any questions on any of those other topics I mentioned? Yes.
You know, I suppose, a little hung up on that plus sign. So I suppose the way the plus sign would look could be different depending on the company. I mean,
sure.
Some industries are more innovative, others are less innovative.
Sure.
So if I work for a company where I'm counsel for a company where I'm not really like in a dynamic plus sign sort of environment, versus I'm counsel at a company where I am in a dynamic plus sign environment. Then I suppose that if I wanted to apply that logic to the way I govern practices at my firm, I suppose I would be different at firm A than I would be applying it differently at firm B.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that you see? I guess in sort of.
I don't see any evidence, frankly. I mean, the fact is the only hard evidence out there is the existence of these studies that show an edge. Right, the existence of the Jagiellonzer study, which shows an edge to people trading in Windows as opposed to trading with, you know, counsel preclearance, and sort of the intuition, my own personal plus sign, you know, in terms of where it's coming from, which is, I think, just common sense. You know, I think it's just common sense. I think, you know, as I said earlier, if you go into a room of non-lawyers and suggest that there is any point in time when executives don't know better what's going on inside their company than the outside world, they laugh at you. And with good reason. With good reason. Company executives should know better than the outside world what's happening inside their own companies at all points in time. The issue, and where the Wall Street Journal and everyone else gets hung up, is that they think that for some reason that knowledge always becomes actionable insider trading kind of knowledge, and it just isn't. The plus sign is not actionable. You can't bring an action for insider trading against Picasso because he had the idea, you know, of putting these two things together into a statute. And yet you can't say that that insight is not valuable. It may be the most valuable part of that whole equation. You know, I mean, Steve Jobs' insight in creating the original iPod is the most valuable thing that he did. That morphed into everything else, the iPhone and everything else, right? Now, when did he get that idea? I don't know. Nobody knows. But he got it at some point.
But is it the uncertainty that's going to be effective that makes it blurred? Because you also have the concept of the Newton.
Correct.
Which, you know, I'm sure he carried around his pocket for a long time too, and that was a total failure.
And that, and as I say, that's why the edge is only 7%. Because, you know, the average edge basically balances out, averages out the correct insights versus the incorrect insights. You know, and the sad thing, as I said earlier, is that the incorrect insights are so many that it reduces the average edge down to only 7%. Any other questions? Have I used up my time?
I didn't really check. Yes, perfect.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, everybody. This has been terrific.
Thank you, Aegis, very much. Thank you all for attending this morning. If anyone in the room on behalf of Rich, Maria, Rova, and myself have any ideas for topics and or want to host a meeting, please feel free to reach out and let us know. I think we are trying to do these quarterly throughout the year, so probably expecting another meeting late summer, early fall. But thank you, and thanks again, Aegis, for coming today.
Thank you.